Okay, so shalom. First of all, I'd like to thank the organizers for giving me this opportunity of being here and also presenting this work, so thank you very much. The work I will tell you about is a collaboration with Eugene and with Anatoly. And it describes some predictions for a universal dynamics of quantum systems that we found by studying the problem of rephasing of two condensates. So I think that really the problem started as with some experimental motivation, which is what happens if we take two independent condensates. So we all know that if you start with two independent condensates, the phase is random to begin with. And what happens if we couple them as a time evolves? So, as before starting the project, we had sort of two expectations which gave us opposite answers, and that's why I think this project made it interesting. So, on one hand, we would say, well, we are coupling the system. In this context, coupling means that you allow particles to tunnel from one side to the other. So, we are coupling them, and therefore, you know, if the particles tunnel, they bring with them the phase, and somehow the two condensates, or quasi-condensates, they should rephase. So there should be some rephasing as function of time. But on the other hand, you would also say, well, what I'm doing here, I'm doing a quench. So we are thinking of sudden quenches. This is what we are talking about. And as such, we know that we are putting some energy into the system. Because even if you start from the ground state, even if you start from the ground state, two independent condensates, when you do the quench, you are in some excited state. That means you have heat of the system. And therefore, and this in general, we know that this leads to dephasing. So the question, in a sense, is who wins, rephasing or dephasing? But more importantly, is the answer universal, or maybe depends on the details of the problem, and so on. So let me give you a hand-waving argument of why at all I would expect the dynamics to be universal. So, and the idea is the following. So when we start at times smaller than zero, the system, the relative phase is not defined. Well, actually, there is a U1 symmetry of the relative phase, and that means that you have gapless modes of the relative phase. So if you think in terms of the spectrum of the relative modes, as function, so there would be some waves which are gapless, you know, these Goldstone modes. That's pretty clear. And then it's also clear that when you turn on the coupling, you will need some finite excitation energy in order to make phase excitation of the relative phase. So now there will be some excitation gap for the relative phase. Okay, so the quench basically goes from a situation in which we have a gapless system with a gapped one. And the question, now we can try to use this argument to evaluate how much energy we are putting in the system. How much are we heating the system? So what we care about is, of course, not the total energy, but the total energy divided by the number of moles. Okay, so this I define as delta E over M. So it's proportional to the gap, of course, because you need an energy scale. This is still sort of a hand waving, but actually it's correct. So you need an energy scale, which is the gap, but then you also need the relative number of modes that you are exciting. As you see here from this graph, these modes here are sort of left unchanged. All the dynamics happens here. So the number of modes that I'm exciting, the relative number of modes that I'm exciting is proportional to the gap divided by the UV cutoff. So the UV cutoff is the total number of modes, and this gives me the delta over lambda gives me the relative number of modes that I'm exciting. So this gives me an approximate, you know, this estimate for the total energy divided by the number of modes. And now the point is that if you are in the weak coupling regime, so meaning that the gap is much smaller than the UV cutoff, like here, gap much smaller than the UV cutoff, then delta E over N is much smaller than the gap. So the energy per mole is much smaller than the gap. Now, these arguments were used here in this paper by people that you may know to study the steady state that the system reaches after a long time. And what we claim here is that this argument actually tells us that there is something universal about the dynamics. And the point here again is that because of the gap, so we have a dynamics which is protected by the gap. Or so it's a low frequency dynamics protected by the gap, and as a consequence, we expect to find some universal quantum dynamics. So I think this is pretty general. And we bring here a specific example of this generic phenomenon.
Question. So you keep saying gap, 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 but the system is still getting there are two gapless modes to begin with. There's one gapless mode after the gap.
Yeah.
After this. So somehow you're only focusing on this relative mode.
But in terms of the energy, yeah. That's correct, right? I'm estimating the energy that I put in the system. So yeah, maybe I should divide it by two. But in terms of scaling, that's the correct.
But in the sense that there's not a gapless mode, how can you talk about being protected by the gap?
Well, okay, so when we will come to the specific examples, we will see, but yes.
We do the quench, you are no longer in the ground state. What is the sense of this gap here?
So the idea is if you take the final Hamiltonian and you study the spectrum of the final Hamiltonian, there would be a gap. But you're right that there is a dynamic. So this is just hand waving. Let us not dwell too much on this. This was just to motivate why I think that the dynamics should be universal. So this is my outlook. I'm going to present the mean field calculation. I will move to one dimension. I promise I will end in time for the cookies. Even if you ask questions, feel free, we will end in time. So the mean field. Okay, mean field. So the mean field here, I mean that it is just a two-mode. Approximation. So the two condensates are just two bosonic modes, psi 1 and psi 2, which are macroscopically occupied. And the Hamiltonian of the system is the following one. So there is an interaction energy in the condensate 1 and the condensate 2, which I assume to be identical. Okay, that will be the assumption for this talk. And in addition, there is some tunneling, which I suddenly turn on. Okay, this is known as the Joule-Zwan junction. You know, it's used to describe Joule-Zwan junction. Here we introduce the idea of the quench, of the sudden quench. Now, the nice thing about this Hamiltonian is so simple, but it has the requirement that we spoke about before. First of all, you see that it's gapless, right? Because the initial Hamiltonian, which is the blue one, is gapless because you see that the energy, the excitation energy, goes like mu over n. So in the thermodynamic limit, which is the limit which we are working on, the energy gap goes to zero. Right? The energy gap is the energy gap initially is mu over n, so it goes to zero in the thermodynamic limit. Instead, in the final Hamiltonian, where we have a finite J term, there is a finite gap. So for those of you that are used to Joule-Zwan junctions, that work in the field of Joule-Zwan junction, this is very natural. It's called the plasma frequency. For those of you who are less into this field, I will try to give to tell you where does this come from in two slides.
But you also got the gradients there, right?
Sorry?
You have gradients in one dimension.
Right, so this is a mean field. The mean field, so I'm assuming that I'm in infinite dimensions. We will come to the one dimension later.
Infinite means zero.
Yes.
Zero. That was the cookie which was really, really small. Yes. Yes. Okay, so you know, just to convince you, this is the numerics, you know, exact dimension of the diagonalization of this Hamiltonian for n equals to 20, and you see that, you know, when the coupling is zero, so which is, you know, far here, there are many, many modes at low frequency, so it's like gapless, and you see that when I turn on some finite coupling, then there is a gap which opens. Okay? This is just, you know, just to so these are the eigen energy is a function of the jump of the coupling, and what we are doing basically we are suddenly quenching from here to here. And we ask what happens. Okay, so we said, well, we expect some universal dynamics. So let's try to see the numerics again. So now I show you some numerics for n equals to 1000, which is very easy to do in the computer. And I show one expectation value, which is the expectation value of this operator. This is the same operator that you had in Hamiltonian. It tells you how much the system is coherent, some sort of coherence factor. And so you see here different plots, a function of time. This is function of time, and this you have this C12 for different values of the couplings. Okay, so the different colors are different values of the couplings. Now, by looking at these curves, maybe you don't see very well that it's universal. They look sort of a little bit of a mess. But what we understand is that what you need to do is that you need to rescale the time with the gap, right? Because the gap is the universal energy scale. So you need to rescale that. And now you see that the very nice data, there is a very nice data collapse. Actually, you can see that as J pep over mu goes to zero, so say this region here, the curves become better and better. So, you know, the red one is not very good because J pep over mu is still large. But when you go to the weak coupling limit, which is the limit of interest here, you go towards a universal curve.
This collapses towards the semi-classical limit.
Yes, thank you. So the question was, what is this universal curve? And the answer, as Jonathan exactly said, is the semi-classical limit. So what you do, you take your Hamiltonian, and now you introduce...
just for the mean field.
The mean field case, I'm still only mean field. We will come to 1D in a moment. But, you know, I think that, you know, if it doesn't work in mean field, it doesn't work in 1D either. If it works in mean field, maybe. Okay, so let's have only the mean field case. So we introduce this phase field phi, you know, by the standard, in the standard way. And now the phi, so psi and n are conjugated. N is conjugate, phi, the phase is conjugate to the number, which means that in the dynamics it is like the velocity, which is proportional to the derivative with respect of time and the position. So it's like time and position, and the canonical conjugate variables, you all know this stuff. Then you introduce this relative phase, which is phi 1 minus phi 2, and what you obtain is this very simple classical equation of motion. So you start from a quantum Hamiltonian, and you end up with classical equation of motions. And now, I'm sure you all recognize this equation of motion as the equation of motion of a simple pendulum, of a nonlinear simple pendulum. Okay, and you also see that there is a single energy scale, which is 2 times mu, 4 times mu times J pel, which is, well, it's square root, right, because you have here time, the set of time squared. So you see that there is, there is a typo here. What I meant is the second derivative set of time of phi. Okay, so there is a single energy scale, this is a single time scale which appears in this universal limit. So n disappears, that's the main point. And it disappears because you went to this limit like that.
Sorry.
Yes.
The quantity you plotted in the previous thing, psi 1, psi 2?
Yes.
That was some kind of expectation value of psi 1, psi 2?
Yes, a function of time.
This is a classical equation. What's a...
Okay, very good. So in this semi-classical representation, what you do is you start from a distribution function. Okay, so you start from a distribution function in which phi is uniform around the whole circle, and then for each point, we evolve it with time. That's what we are doing. So the nice thing here is that these equations are analytically solvable by elliptic functions. So what you do, you know, you start from a unitary distribution around the circle, and you evolve all the points separately, that's why semi-classical separately, and you see what happens. And then what you compute, for instance, is the cosine phi. So initially the cosine phi is zero because you have a circle, and then it's like you have a gravitational force towards left, well, your left. So towards left, that means that now you have collapse, and then cosine phi acquires a finite expectation value, and there are oscillations in this harmonic oscillator, and this is exactly what you see here. So the black curve is an analytic solution of the semi-classical equation with this random, with this uniform distribution function to begin with. And you see that it, you know, but I guess it's pretty good. Okay, so, questions until here? No. Okay, that was for the mean field, so it was very simple. And now we go to one dimension. And in one dimension, the point is that you don't have a macroscopic occupation of the ground state, so you cannot use this two-mode approximation. You all know this, even if you're in the ground state. And so the description that we will use is the following, is a Luttinger liquid description, in which we describe the two phi 1 and phi 2, sorry, the two condensates as quasi-condensates, so like two Luttinger liquids, and the tunneling between the two quasi-condensates is given by this cosine term. And theta of t is the step function, so I'm considering only certain quenches.
So you're going to be thinking about zero temperature initial?
So, right. So I start from the ground state of these two independent Luttinger liquids, and I suddenly turn on. In the last slide, I will tell you something about the temperature. So what then you introduce is, again, this relative and center of mass coordinates, and what happens here is that the two theories decouple. So you have the center of mass coordinates, nothing happens to them, and the center and the relative coordinates, they are described by Quanshin and Sine Gordon. So now, of course, you can always question why is this field theoretical approach valid at all? And the reason is in the first slide. So the first slide told you that we are dealing with very low energies. We are heating the sample just a little bit. And that's very important. Otherwise, you are, in general, not allowed to use field theories when the sky may quench. If you heat it a lot, then this universality gap goes away. But in this particular case, where you start from a ground state of phi lactate liquid, and you suddenly turn on a cosine, which is small, that works.
So if you have slight inhomogeneity in G, so now you couple total mode,
Case
with the relative, isn't that a relevant perturbation in this story?
Okay, I never thought about the problem.
This is what Vadim basically asked, whether you do have a coupling with remaining gapless mode.
Right. So well, I would say well, disorder is relevant in 1D in any case. So if it is relevant at equilibrium, then more so.
Not even disorder, just small step, but just to break translational invariance.
So like an impurity, a local impurity, you mean?
Or a trend. Well, not so because his cosine only goes by 1 minus phi 2, if the first two terms are harmonic Laurentian liquids, then even with a homogeneity in G, you will not couple to the uniform, to the symmetric law. I think what I was having in mind is if the first two terms are non-linearities,
Right, but so I think that the question to your answer is basically, what about irrelevant couplings, like say phi 1 to the 4th, which would then translate into some coupling, and the statement is that because we are dealing with the dynamics which is governed by the ground state, so it's really many-body quantum dynamics is governed by ground state, then the arguments that you would have about from equilibrium that you can, but it's certainly a very good question, and it would be very nice, you know, to extend this to really formalize it through RG. There actually has been such an attempt, or you know, this is actually something that has been done in a very recent paper by Aditi Mitra, where she exactly studied the quenching the Stein-Gordon. And I will not talk about her work, but it is, I think, in good agreement what we find. There is maybe even some overlapping, and for the details about the RG, you can ask Aditi directly. Yes, please.
Okay. You said the assumption is you do not put too much heat in this system.
Yeah.
Which energy scale do you...
So G. It means that G is small. We are turning on the cosine, which is small. Okay, we will see. So the gap is proportional to G, right? So it means that the gap is small, which means that G is small.
But in a certain parameter region, this is the gap case, right?
It's always gap. Well, exactly. We are dealing where it is gap, but the gap is small. Small with respect to the UV cutoff. Okay? So actually, there has been another paper, which I will tell you about, which is the paper by Yuchen Casalila, which also studied the quenching the Stein-Gordon. Okay, so I will tell you about, but there are many, many more work. I already apologize if I forgot to mention one of the works in the audience. Probably, and most probably I did forget, but you know, in the paper they will all appear, and if not, write me. So quenching the Stein-Gordon. What is nice about Stein-Gordon? It is basically a little bit unphysical, but what is nice about it, that it has many, many different options. The cosine can be relevant, irrelevant, turn it on, turn it off. You can really play with it, and you can have many different situations. So let me describe what are the situations which seem to be more physical and has been studied. Option A is the case in which you had a cosine and you turn it off. So if you turn off the cosine, that means that there is no gap. If there is no gap, that means that at long times, the dynamics is thermal. And it's classical or thermal because the modes here have such a small frequency that any energy you put them, they already feel, you know, very, very excited about it. So they are thermal. This is one case. The other case is the following. Now we want to turn on a cosine, but the cosine will be irrelevant. Okay, so now we turn on a cosine which is irrelevant. What does it mean to turn a cosine which is irrelevant? That means that if we start, let's say, from a linear dispersion, then we are doing something at high momentum, right? Because irrelevant means that it's large here and small here. So turning on irrelevant means going from this linear to this one. And if you repeat the hand-waving argument that we gave before, what you find is that the energy is extremely large. That makes sense, right? Because you are exciting the high frequency modes. And that's why you are putting a lot of energy. And if you are putting a lot of energy, the dynamics most probably is dominated by the non-universal part.
So it's irrelevant when the new parameter is greater than 2?
Yes, that's in this notation. Mm, yeah. So that's why I wrote it, because you're right. So what, the third situation, and actually that's the one we will study. So we will study a situation in which we are turning on the cosine, and the cosine is relevant. Okay, that's the case we are studying. We went from a linear dispersion to this type of dispersion. The amount of energy is very weak, and the dynamics is dominated by the universal part of the spectrum. Okay.
So what does this K equal to correspond to in a more microscopic?
This is the relative mode. So in the Luttinger liquid, it's 1 over 2k, so it would be 1/4. It's 1/4 in the k of the phase. This is k of phi, the k of theta for the single mode would be 1/4. Okay? So let's go on. Yeah, so...
Can I go to the previous slide?
Yes.
It seems to me the second case... For the second case, the field theory may not be valid at all.
Yeah, that's the idea. That's the idea. That's what I'm trying to say. Yeah, thank you. So when we want to study this problem, there is one thing which you would do first, and this was done by the paper of Yuchen Casalilla, to say, well, the cosine is so complicated, let's try to approximate by phi squared, which means that I take independent modes. Okay, now I have independent modes, so for each momentum I have an independent mode. So I have an harmonic oscillator, that I know to solve, and therefore I can solve the problem this way. So what happens is that initially for a given mode, this is a given mode, you start from an harmonic potential, and then, now look at the PowerPoint, then you suddenly, again, you suddenly close it, right? Because you always go to higher frequencies. You're opening a gap, so we go to higher frequencies, which means you make your harmonic confinement larger, and then the dynamics that you will observe is just, you know, oscillations. The point is that this, so the frequency of the oscillation depends on how much you do this quench, but the amplitude of the oscillation depends on the initial amplitude of fluctuations. If you had some fluctuations to begin with, after the oscillations will not reduce the amplitude of the oscillation, because this is harmonic oscillator, it's not damping, right? So that means that if initially the phi q squared went like 1 over q, which is the Luttinger liquid, right? Okay, for those of you who are used to it, so phi q goes like 1 over q, now it will go like 1 over q, again, maybe 1/2 if you average over a period. So you do not reduce the quantum fluctuations at all. And as a consequence, if phi q squared is 1 over q, that means that now phi squared of x, which is the integral over the momentum, is logarithmically divergent in the thermodynamic limit goes to infinity, and therefore phi squared is infinity, and cosine phi goes to 0. I'm not sure if you followed all this argument, certainly those who are not used to Luttinger liquid physics, but the main message is, if you take the single mode approximation, the independent mode approximation, sorry, the system does not rephase. Okay, that was the prediction by Yuchen Casalilla. He said we used the independent mode approximation, we didn't find any rephasing at all. Why is wrong? Why is wrong? I will tell you that it is wrong, but just one second. We sort of understand that something is wrong because we assume that the modes are independent, but they are not, because the cosine couples all the modes together. So maybe this is wrong, and if you read carefully the paper by Yuchen Casalilla, they say we are very suspicious about this result. We don't know what's wrong. We see that something is wrong, but yes, please.
Could you define what you mean by rephasing?
Rephasing? Rephasing means that you have a finite expectation value of cosine phi. Cosine phi is the phase coherence, and to start with, there is no coherence at all. The phase is random, cosine phi is zero. And then as time goes on, I ask, does the expectation value of cosine phi require a finite expectation value or not? And they found that cosine phi was always zero. Okay? Good.
So, if I wanted to say differently, you want to have somehow phi 1 minus phi 2 become 0, in some sense. That if I look at the phi 1 minus phi 2, that should sort of, initially it's a random distribution,
yeah.
That should sort of
Right.
So there shouldn't be fluctuations in phi 1 minus phi 2, but if you approximate it as an effective quadratic theory, you can never force that because of energy conservation.
Right, exactly. So you're right. So you can see the same in the single mode approximation. If I took my cosine phi and I approximated by phi squared, this wouldn't work.
The energy conservation would work.
Right. So we understand the cosine is really important. So it's important to take all the cosine. And because this is an institute for theoretical physics, I thought that nevertheless I will show you some equations. I hope they will, well, so at least, you know, I will not really derive everything, but at least the scaling, okay? I will show you how you get the scaling. So you want to compute this the expectation value of cosine phi, use field theoretical techniques. So you write down a path integral for phi, expectation value of cosine phi, times e to the action. The action has two parts, the Luttinger liquid and the cosine. Then, now, in the field in field theories, cosine phi is just a number, so you can Taylor expand it. You Taylor extend it, and that's what you get. So the exponent now becomes, you know, 1 over n, ig to the power n, this factor to the power n, the cosine phi, and you have this e to the I s naught. So this is, you know, the bare action. It's actually, it's basically the starting point, the Luttinger liquid. So that I use this notation, this expectation value with respect to the initial condition. Now, the nice thing here is that the dynamics is very complicated, but the initial condition is easy, because the initial condition is Luttinger liquid. So this expectation value, I can compute it exactly. And I will not show it here, but what I can tell you, well, as you expect, this is a power law. The only scale here is time, so it must be some power law of time. And when you do the calculation, this is what you obtain. So you obtain, so there are some numbers, you know, which comes in this Cn. So Cn is some numbers. I have the expression for those of you. I can show you it later. But if there is some numbers, there is this g to the power n, and there is mu t, so t to the some power. Okay, t to the some power, you see that what you have here is t to the power 2n. 2n comes from the integrals, right? You have 2n integrals. You have n integrals over time, n integrals over space gives you 2n. And then you have n plus 1 cosine. The scaling dimension of the cosine is k over 2, so you have n plus 1 times k over 2. Now, the trick is the following. Now, what we do is we rescale the time with respect to the gap, right? That's what we understood from the near field. What you need to do is rescale the time with respect to the universal energy scale, which is the gap. So now we know that the gap is proportional to g to the power 1 divided by 2 minus k. This you know it from RG. Actually, it's known from the exact result of the Stein-Gordon by form factor approach. The self-consistent variational approach will tell you the same. So this is the result. And this is the result. Now I just basically multiply and divide by the gap. And when I do that, what I obtain is the following. So the nice thing is what happens after I rescale. So I basically just divide and multiply by g to the power 1 over 2 minus k. And then what happens is the following. That I have a function which is only a function of delta, of the gap, and there is a prefactor. But the prefactor comes out. So all the terms have the same prefactor. That's the nice part. That this scaling part here comes out. So you have many, many terms, but they all have the same scaling, apart from some function of the inverse gap. So after you rescale with the gap, you get something universal.
Is there a plus in that exponent? 2n plus n plus 1 k over 2?
2n plus again? So and minus, this is minus. Minus, minus, minus. Minus, minus, minus. Next line.
It must be.
Everywhere, plus and minuses. Okay. we can check it. But the result is correct. So this is the main result. I just wanted to show that in terms of scaling, it's very simple. It's a very simple derivation. And this very simple derivation tells us that the expectation value of cosine phi of t is a function of time. Okay. So, but it's a universal function of time with respect to the inverse gap. Now, because this is one of the main results, let me spend 2 minutes on this result and tell you two things. First, this scaling dimension that you got here, this gap to the power k, this is exactly the same scaling that you would get in the expectation value of the ground state of the final Hamiltonian. So this is really dynamics. However, in terms of scaling, it's a ground state dynamics. It's a dynamics which is governed by the ground state. And as such, the anomalous exponents are given by the ground state. Now, the interesting part, so this is sort of trivial a little bit, but the interesting part is this one, which tells you that actually you get a universal function of the inverse gap. Well, maybe both of them are trivial, but combined together, they are nice. So there is a dynamics and there is a anomalous scaling. I think that's the idea. Now, let me stress that this scaling function is expected to work, or is predicted to work, both for short times and for long times with respect to the inverse gap. And that means that if you, for instance, do numerics and you have problems in going for long times, or if you do an experiment, the experiment is not too is open, so you have noise and so on. But if you know to do very well the short times, then you can predict something about the long times. And this idea has been used for classical critical points. It was first proposed by, in this paper, later verified by numerics, and it actually, there is actually a whole field of this, of using, you know, short time dynamics to predict long time or equilibrium critical exponents, and the very recent review of, is here. So this was proposed for classical system. Now we, the idea is that it should work also for quantum systems. Last sentence about this slide is that, and I will answer the questions, is that, okay, here we were able to show that the scaling ansatz work by this non-perturbative expansion, by showing that, you know, all the integrals, they have the same thing, scaling exponent. In other words, maybe you can take it as an ansatz and you can check if it works or not. You know, it's not, here we were able to show that it indeed works. There were two questions. Yes, Marco.
Yeah. So, so I guess I understand that for time scale much smaller than 1 by delta, it's fine. I don't see. So for time scale much larger than that, can you resum that series so that the function is?
Well, you see from, well, that is the result. You don't know what is the number that you will get. So you will get a number.
But that series convergent, you're saying.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of. Well, it's kind of non-trivial statement.
Right? I mean, formally it might be that. Good.
But so you have many, many terms.
It doesn't work, you must have phase transition of time.
Wait, that's a different.
So this is the series that you get, right? So let's look at the series. So as function of time, each term of the series becomes larger and larger and larger. However, you have many of them. And what happens is that they solve all of them equilibrate. And in the end you get to a constant number. But this is non-trivial.
So what is CL?
How can scale with them?
How does CN? But CN is given by some complicated integrals, and I don't know.
Given by cancellation.
Yes. Yes. So there is a minus one. Okay. The CNs are alternating signs. The CN have alternating signs. Okay. And this comes from this I to the. Well, no, it does not come from. It comes from here because the Ns must be all. Odd, you know, it's like a Coulomb gas expansion. So you, this is just like a Coulomb gas expansion, and what you get is there is a minus one to the power n. So these Cn's come with opposite signs, and this is called dynamical sum problem because it, I mean, this is causes a serious dynamical sum problem.
Okay, actually, before we get to that, so the absolute value of Cn's, they grow.
The absolute
is definitely not absolutely convergent.
No, it's not absolutely convergent. No, no. So Aditi had a question.
Well, actually, that final expression that you have, I wanted to ask you, in the long time limit, how does it compare with the equilibrium expectation value?
So that's a question which...
But you answer this question.
The variables to
constant.
Well, it is a number, so it is the same scaling as the ground state, not necessarily the same number. Like you saw, for instance, in the classical approach, in the mean field, you see clearly that in ground state you should get 1, right? Because it was in classical, it should be 1, and instead you get 0.7. It is the same scaling, not the same number.
Yeah. And also, there is a duality in this Coulomb gas?
No, because this is a sine Gordon. For the impurity, you have this duality.
Oh,
I don't think this is sine Gordon, so.
Okay.
I don't. Well, okay. In the questions session, if you will have time, I will show you the expression for CN, so you will be satisfied.
So you can turn this question around and say, the value that you get in the steady state, what temperature would that correspond to? Do you have any idea how?
No. You see, for the scaling, it's like ground state scaling. It's not a temperature. The temperature would be basically, well, very low, much smaller than the gap. So it's not like the temperature would change the scaling. The scaling is the same, the number which is different.
Question. So
I'm
tuned to the K equals
2.5. Okay. Very good. So the it will come here. So now this result is to me it's nice, but it's not enough because what I used is was the long time asymptotics is the long time asymptotics of the. Of the integrals. However, these integrals are performed from 0 to t. So I have also the short times. The short time will give me a number which I don't know what it is. So there is this universal prediction. Now I rewrote it in terms of g, okay, the decoupling. But there is also something else. And the point is the following. Here I have a claim. And the claim is that this physics here, this second part, comes from the Ewley physics. And as a consequence, it must be an analytic function of the bare parameters. Okay, it must be an analytic function of the beta parameters. As such, I can always do a Taylor expansion in the beta parameters, and well, for g equals to 0, it's 0, so it must be at most linear. And then we have these two contributions, universal contribution and the non-universal contribution. And now the point is that if k is smaller than 1...
Why is it linear? I'm sorry.
At most, what else could it be?
G squared.
Well, I also have g squared, but g is small. So this is much smaller than this.
G is not analytic.
No, g is my bare coupling. It's my bare coupling.
Still, g, when g goes, the sign of g doesn't matter for this. So I think the
lead... no, because you're expecting also the cosine phi need to revert it. No. It's the symmetry is correct. You can have a g squared. Yes?
How does r delta t behave short times?
R to the delta t?
You know it from the
analytic expression, right? So it's the first term. So the first term gives you delta t to the power okay, so there is.
But you have to resum all the terms there.
Yeah. No. But at short times, you see, it's proportional to t. So at short times, the first one dominates. For t much smaller than delta, only the first term dominates, which is first. Is that what I'm doing here is time-dependent perturbation theory. Okay, sorry, I forgot to mention it. Just doing time-dependent perturbation theory to any order.
So it is delta t to the power kappa?
Yeah, something like, well, I think maybe there is a typo here, but yeah, something like that.
But you're saying short time, but there's somehow saying that the...
No. So, okay, there is a timescale separation.
Yeah.
There is the UV cutoff. I don't know what happens before the 1 over UV cutoff.
Yeah.
And there is the inverse gap. So small means small with respect to the inverse gap, not small with respect to the UV cutoff, which is the macroscopic physics. Of course, I know nothing about the macroscopic physics, right? But okay, so here we have this argument, and the point is, if k is smaller than 1, so here we come to your question, if k is smaller than 1, then this part is this exponent is larger than 1, which means that when g goes to 0, this is the one which remains. Okay, again, if k is smaller than 1, then this part is the universal part is dominant. So you can see it in an experiment, because you know, in an experiment you don't know to distinguish between these two parts. But if k is smaller than 1, then you can go to smaller g's, and you will see that this is the dominant part. Okay? Now, notice that k equals to 1 is not the point where k equals to 2, which is the point where it becomes relevant. So that means the cosine must be very relevant.
Okay, that's what happens.
You need to, that the scaling dimension of cosine must be larger than 1. So very relevant cosine. Okay? And this is related to this non-equilibrium physics. So now, the point k equals to 1 is the one which is refermionized. That was done by Yuchen Casalila. What they found is that they found two parts, a universal part and a non-universal part. The universal, and both they were scaling like g. So this is as I predicted. For k equals to 1, they both rescale as g. And then you cannot distinguish. And you know, that's the reason why Yuchen Casalila suspected these independent modes not to be valid, because they say, how comes that in this point we do get something? And here we explain exactly what's going on.
Okay, so I think for k between 1 and 2, this is still right, but it's just a subleading correction. But it's not, it's still there.
Yes.
But for k bigger than 2, it's not there. So for k bigger than 2, you have completely analytical expression. For k smaller,
yes,
between 1 and 2, you have some leading normality.
Yes.
If it's a smaller one, then 1 is actually the interval.
Yes.
But for both gases, k is never less than 1.
Sorry? No, so in k much smaller than 1 means weakly interacting. Okay? I'm using a notation which is not the standard one. So basically, that's very good. I mean, in experiments, k is much smaller than 1. Actually, what we will see, what we will not see, because we don't have time, but in experiments, k is so small that it's almost 0. And if you take k equals to 0, you get back to the mean field. Okay, right? Because when k equals to 0, you remember that. Okay, so let me show the numerics. This is time-dependent EMRG done on hardcore Boson's ladder. The single chain is beta ansa solvable. The ladder, I don't know. I think it's not, but you may correct me. In any case, we use time-dependent EMRG. And the nice part, because each chain is beta ansa solvable, then I know what is k. I have an analytic expression. I put in some jump j and v, and I know what is k. And then I do my numerics, I compute cosine phi for different values of coupling, I rescale all of that. Notice that what you need to do is to rescale both the time and the cosine. This is this anomalous scaling, anomalous dimension, and which is not at mean field. And indeed, if you take k equals to zero, you go back to the mean field, and there is no need to rescale this thing here. So you only rescale that. The black curve is the thing that I will obtain from trying to do a perturbation theory, so to resum the integrals. After some time, I cannot, it's dynamical. So I get this and then MS, so I don't know, but the blue thing, I think there is very good agreement. Sure, okay. Okay, well, you're very good. This is the last slide. So my last slide is more about universality. So, okay, that was nice, but is it useful? And I think the concept of universality is very useful because it allows you to answer many questions without the need to really compute them. Now, when you will need to publish, maybe you'd better check them. So we check them. But, for the slide, this is fine. So one question which experimentalists asked us is the following. Well, I cannot do a quench. I always have a run. It takes me some time to get from zero to finite time. How fast should I be? Or, second question, is I don't have zero temperature, sorry. I need a finite, so how cold should I be? Or, third question, and I wanted to mention this because I think it's interesting, and also because Adelaide was involved in this work, what about spatial integrated coherence? So in that case, what you do, well, to study one-dimensional physics, it's basically a question of the size. How large should be the system be in order to observe this 1D physics? And the answer to all these questions is basically the gap, right? This universal quantity, which is the gap. This universal low energy physics, which is the gap, so the ramp should be much smaller than 1 over delta, the temperature must be much smaller than delta. Turns out that this is the not less easy part. And in terms of finite size scaling, you need to do finite size scaling with respect to the gap, or the inverse gap. Okay? So I promise that we'll be in time for the cookies. We are. The summary is given here. Next questions that we would like to ask is, for instance, we spoke about sudden quenches, but people also speak a lot about slow ramps. So how do you go from one minute to the other? How do you cross over from the universality of the sudden quench to the universality of the Killeberg-Zurich? What are these, for the 1D case, what is this curve that I showed you? Can I have an analytic expression for it? And can I send these ideas of universal scaling dynamics in where, for instance, for in condo case, where they know to do short times very well, but they have problems for long times? Maybe this idea of universal scaling can help. Thank you.
I guess we should postpone the questions.
Well, have 2 minutes.
Have
you started 2 minutes, right?
Yes. Yeah. So, what's the typical delta in experimental systems?
So delta is given by the coupling. So in principle, you would want it to be very small, right? You can make it as small as you wish. You can tune it by just tuning the tunneling coupling between the two quantum states. You have pretty much freedom of it. The problem is the following. On one hand, you would like to have data, the gap very small, because then it's more universal. On the other, the temperature kills you. So you need to have a regime where this physics. So you need to be an intermediate regime. Yes.
So the final statement is function is universal. So on all time scale, not just time scale much smaller than the 1 over the gap.
Exactly.
On all time scale,
yes,
is the zero temperature gap that gives you the scale.
Exactly. And the reason is that we are heating the sample very just a little bit. So we are putting. If you think in terms of thermalization, if you think of the electron, where do I thermalize? I thermalize to a temperature which is much smaller than the gap. And then yes. Ground state expectation values make sense. Maybe not the number, but the scaling.
Let me give Paul that it came from CV Jamarkin, so they saw in classes in yourself. One sort of interesting thing out of this, that actually if you can do short time expansion, experimentally or numerically up to second order, you can immediately figure out what's long time isotopic going to be. Because you basically have in short times, you always analytic in G, in your coupling, in short times, perturbation theory works, but time appears in some weird powers. So as soon as you're able to write it as a single function of G times some power, then you immediately know the factor, the system, okay. But basically, if you don't know in theory, if you know short time expansion up to second order, you can predict up to constant point steady state.
But don't you have to be worried about at short times sort of being contaminated by the non-universal pieces?
Sure. Time should be bigger than 1/1.
Right.
Cut so off, shorter than 1/1. And they use it in glasses a lot, because numerically you cannot simulate long time limits, but the same works for.
Okay.